This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Dorrit Carroll's here. She's a lawyer, she's a poet, but today she's all poet. And here's an opening poem.
The snow is there faint. The snow is there faint as a word spoken in another room. If I squint, I can make out the flitter of it, white gnats pestering a streetlight. Sometimes the yoga teacher says, breathe in with your soul, and I think, I have no soul, nothing but my tin can empty self, washed and ready for recycle. Sometimes in church they preach on the sense of the faithful, and it's a foghorn that's supposed to steer you toward or away from the shoals of God, depending. But when I listen inside myself, all I hear is water on rocks. And sometimes at a movie, people near me are crying, and I wonder what happened to them. That didn't happen to me. But now I'm thinking maybe it's all like snow falling in a warm climate, that you have to accept how little of it there is, that you have to know where to look.
That is the voice of Dorrit Carroll. She is a Washington, D.C. person and lives in Bethesda. She's received her undergraduate and law degrees from Georgetown, still practices law, and her poems have been in many, many prestigious magazines. She has two books out, and I love the first title. The first book, which was a chapbook, is called Sorry, You Are Not an Instant Winner. Are you an instant winner now, Dorrit?
Maybe.
I think today you are. So tell us, I mean, if someone says, Dorrit Carroll, what are her poems about? If you're pressed to consolidate your canon, what are your themes?
I've written a lot about family, but when you asked me that question, I wanted to say triumphing over grief, which is nothing I would have even said about my poems till you asked that question.
Well, I'm glad I did. Then give us another poem and we'll judge for ourselves.
And never stops at all. I sat on the back porch as our handyman's daughter explained the world to me. People keep on pondering upon the problem, she said, when they should be pondering upon the solution. She repeated it, pondering upon, and it made me think of walking on water, upon a pond. We were both impressed with the phrase. She was 18, I think, had dropped out of high school and was in the first flush of love with a boy in the grocery store where she worked. My mother had given us lemonade that tasted like the day, sharp, bright, early spring. But what I remember most is how this girl embodied her name, Hope. She shook her sandy bangs out of her eyes with hope, drew hearts on the condensation of her glass with hope, and every time she named the boy, little bells in her voice joined the ice cubes in her glass in a clink of hope, hope, hope. She was pregnant already, although neither of us knew it. The baby was 3 months old when the boy, speeding and high, crashed their Chevy into a pole and killed them both. Her mother raised the baby, who of course had her own name, but always answered to Hope's daughter.
Oh, Dorrit, how I think of you, I listen to you, it is so magical, and I think she is a lawyer. How I can see how the narrative tracks with linear thinking. I can see how people and telling a story comes from, it tracks with law, but the way you play with words, imagistically, that is so far away from my feeling about the law. Pondering upon, using those words that double back on themselves, then descriptions like sharp, bright, early spring, those clear, definitive words. How does law intersect with your poetry?
When I was in the middle of a litigation as a young lawyer, in absolute misery, surrounded by boxes of documents, my friend and I, who were a little stoned from exhaustion, got into a conversation about the value of words. And he concluded or I concluded that law taught you that words have a mathematical value like X, and you want that X to be consistent in a poem, even if the things you multiply it by, like Y or 3, change how it is in what you're doing. And I thought, this is great. Law has forced me to that level of precision.
Well, that is an excellent answer. Because precision I can understand, but magic? How do you explain that away? I mean, it's so whimsical, so delightful, that you do have a different style. Have you ever written a brief?
I've written millions of briefs.
Are you actually in the courthouse?
When I was young, now because I work for a federal agency, I argue before their board.
And what is your specialty?
Trademarks, intellectual property.
That is so complicated. Oh, my. Okay, we're clear here. We're good. Dorit Carroll, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and she has an awful lot to say.
Medicare. I learned about dry shampoo when the nurses cleaned my father's hair as he lay in the dead bed that we rented from the You Won't Need This For Long Because It's Fatal company. I also learned that the nails of the almost dead grow and grow, segmented and terrible, until my father's feet resembled the claws of a bear, the metal bed a trap that had us all by the ankle. Every day at 1 p.m., when I gave him the anti-seizure medication, on cue, my mother began to chime, repeating 2 times, 3 times, sometimes 11, that it was me and my dropper of Keppra and not the brain tumor that made his eyes wander off in different directions, like Hansel and Gretel had split up in the forest to try their separate luck. "You did this, you did this, you did this," she caroled, while the nurses and I rebalanced his rolling head on the pillows to make it seem like he was looking at her. Then she'd rush off to buy another lemon or lime meringue pie at the grocery store, stuffing in the neon green and yellow bites as if she could make him firm again by filling him. And no matter how many bites she already had crammed in, his final act of obedience was to open up his mouth for more. His gray lips hard and gaping, the scarred spoon baited with the foamy meringue, a hook she would use to catch him, to reel him back.
Crammed in, such an important verb. That is a powerful poem. That's a private poem. And had she read that?
No, I'm not sure my mother could read.
Would read?
She tried to read because my mother was mentally not well. She was so emotionally disorganized that I think when she got to the end of the sentence, she couldn't process the beginning anymore.
Well, it's a brave poem. Because you dare to say the truth, the analogy of the pie and the hook and the subservience and the obedience all in that lemon meringue pie. And such a startling contrast where you were administering something healthful but did not get credit for that. Is that something you experienced a lot? It sounds pretty emblematic.
Yes, I didn't have to make up much of that poem.
but does it take courage to write it?
It takes some pain to write it. I don't know if that's courage.
Then is the pain away afterwards? Is it a good way to be able to put it in the drawer and say, well, now that episode that felt so bad is in a drawer now. It's not in my head.
Some.
Mm-hmm. But there's plenty more where that came from, right?
I think you just feel, well, okay, it's done. I got it as right as I could get it.
That is as good as it gets. I mean, what act of completion is there in life that could be more healing? I did the best I could with this. First of all, I was careful. Tell me some of the adjectives that it takes to be an honest poet.
I want to say respectful, because even though you might be angry at someone in the poem, or the poem might even be describing something disgusting, you want to have respect for the people and how they were feeling at that moment. Not take them to the point of caricature. Recognize that they had sincere motivations.
And we do feel bad about your mother. We do see her intentions were...
She was desperate.
Of course. And so you don't make her unsympathetic. And I think that's really important. So there's the respect. Yes. And when you think of that situation, do you run it like a film across your mind? Or did you take notes as you were watching it?
I think of myself as a photographer, except that instead of a camera, I have a pen. When I read that poem, I can tell you the shag rug was made up of yellow and orange threads. I can tell you what medical books my father had on the shelves on the wall, probably in order. I see it that clearly.
That is a gift for a poet, collecting imagery, visual imagery, and putting them in a little folder in your brain, right? Now about your craft. How do you decide how to enter a poem so that you aren't knocking a door over or falling over your feet?
I've tried to get over what they call throat clearing, that introductory couple of lines that don't need to be there. That's something I'm learning now. The first poem, I simply looked out at that fizzling snow, the only snow we've really gotten in Washington this year, and I was thinking about how I don't mourn, I don't sob. I've lost both parents and my brother at this point, but I very much go on, the laundry's always done. And I was wondering if I was quite human. And I looked out at the snow and I thought, well, it's there. You have to look.
That's an interior process that winds up on the page.
Yes.
And so that you are very reflective of what you're feeling. And then you see something in the exterior world and put them together, it sounds like.
Yeah.
That sounds like your MO. Let's hear another poem. Dorrit Carroll.
Freud watches birds. In the beginning is a black leather couch, neat as a cake of seeds. And a man in a dark gray jacket, skating his rolling chair back and forth on a square of plastic that covers the rug. The man stays in his chair behind his desk, out of view of the person who lies on the couch facing the window. In the beginning are the words, spoken by that patient on the couch. They fly up like birds and bump into the glass of the window, see goldfinches and titmice in the branches outside, and begin to sing to their uncaged brethren, while the doctor, my father, notes down the outdoor species, checking his Birds of North America guide. By now the patient has hatched an entire flock, cedar waxwing fantasies, black crow night terrors, and all the sparrows and magpies of ordinary irritation. In a kaleidoscope of wings, they crowd each other at the ceiling, while my father says, yes, yes, go on. Finally, the desk clock trembles from the 49th to the 50th minute, and the session is concluded for the day. The patient stands up and opens the office door, and a raucous cone of birds streams after him, as if my father had just handed him the strings to an enormous bundle of balloons.
Talk to us about ordinary irritation.
I think that a shrink, well, I know a shrink from having been my father's assistant. I collaborated, typed up his papers. It was my beginning of editing English. And I know that they look in themselves and look at their own reactions to try and understand what the patient's feeling. But here's the duality of the patient's fantasies being so beautiful and bird-like in a kaleidoscope, and my father is very rigidly checking his Birds of North America guide, which he really did. He was a bird watcher, and he couldn't resist writing it down, even if it was in the middle of the patient.
But there's so many levels to that, using the birds. so that he's actually doing it. And also there is his search for authenticity as the scientist for the imagination, matching himself against the imagination of the patient. And so you were privy to something very important about human behavior early on.
Well, and I probably people don't know this in the poem, but I wanted to start with the image of the skating minister, which is a famous Scottish piece of art, and I'm forgetting who the artist was. I think it was made in the 1700s, and it's this black-coated minister all alone skating and having a moment of abandon on the ice. So my father is the minister, this rigid figure who yet has his moment of abandon, sort of. He looks at the real birds, but he misses the kind of the beauty of the patient's rich fantasy life.
But is that true of the scientist, maybe?
I think it's problem. I think some scientists overcome it.
Yeah, I agree with that. I want you to read a poem and then tear it apart.
All right, I'm going to switch the order real quick because
I know which one. Oh, for a lawyer, that is going to be traumatic.
I know which one we should tear apart.
Because we like to know what's going on with you and where you got the idea and where you were standing when you thought of it, when you wrote it, and how many times you rewrote it, and what it's all about.
I've rewritten this poem so many times, it's depressing. Hundreds.
We're at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and she is Dorrit Carroll.
We come warning you, trouble is, says the fake IRS call, buzzing from a boiler room in Tianjin, a crinkling in the air like the sound of flies on a windowsill waving their last legs. On the screen before me is the PET scan emailed by the hospital that shows my mother's lungs dappled with cancer like the Rorschach spots on butterfly wings. The standard uptake value of the dye that proves malignancy is any number over 2.5. My mother's tumors measure 17, 5.8, 13, and 27, as if they drank this nectar greedily and quick. In an attachment to the message is a prescription for narcotic patches. When pasted on the patient's back, their saturated gauze is candle white. The patient's lungs rise up to it like moths. Gradually, the patient curls in upon herself, knees to chest, head to knees, as if the illness is a fist squeezing something gossamer it snatched from air. Each breath, the agitated rattle of something that can't quite shake itself loose. A gibberish repetition. This is your final. This is your final.
Now tell us about it.
I did receive a robocall on the day that I got my mother's results, and we knew she would be dying very soon. And the robocall was poorly recorded and became or degenerated into nonsense. And I felt like my mother was disintegrating like the language of that call was disintegrating. But then the question was, what did I do? Because the poem's divided into numeric sections, and they don't necessarily have something to do with each other, although they do. So they're a little bit like working in collage. This is everything I saw and heard in that moment. And I hope it makes a coherent whole, but I stopped struggling to make it super linear in the end, and I left it.
Numbering each stanza.
I originally had the gibberish of the call between each stanza. It came to seem like it made the poem too much gibberish and too interrupted. But I guess I wanted to write myself an excuse or a permission slip for the fact that the sections don't relate linearly.
So you were trying something artificial that did not work.
It may not still.
I think it tells a story very clearly to me. So I think you're good.
Okay.
You don't have to do a 100th draft. You can put that one away. But we'll see about the next one. Dorrit Carroll has two books. And what is the title of your second book?
A glottal stop.
That's right. I was afraid to say it because it's written how?
G-L-T-T-L space S-T-P.
And what is a glottal stop?
It can mean several things, but in singing it means when you use the epiglottis to stop the flow of air without taking a new breath. So I wanted to write a book about the things we choke back and don't say.
Oh.
And then I took out the vowels because it choked more.
Terrific. That is terrific. What are you going to read for us next?
This is called A Meditation on Purgatory. A Meditation on Purgatory. The dog lies half in the road, half on the curb, like a comma in a sentence you can't take back. A small humped bridge between right now and the second before the speeding car. The intact part of the day receding beneath you like the ground from under a climbing plane. Sometimes past and present stand on either side of a pane of glass and stare at each other. A visit between the life you intended and the one you'll be living after. The unlocked gate, the fleeting lapse of concentration, the momentary flame of anger on the kindling of your never-dependable self-control. Sometimes your four red finger marks linger on the face of your child like pox. Sometimes you lift your eyes and let your partner see they're rimmed and empty as old cups. Sometimes when you call, the dog does not come back.
I was watching over your shoulder, seeing that these are in couplets, and I think I know why.
Why?
I think unconsciously, it's just the absolute perfect form for that poem, which is about duality and the past and the present separated by the glass in itself is so interesting. And you carry that through the poem. There's the dog half on the curb and half out of the curb. And so unconsciously, I bet, you knew to put that into two lines at a stanza.
I don't know if I know why, but I had the poem in several forms, and this was the one that seemed satisfying to me. I think a lot about how we look at each other through a glass. Sometimes we're not really in contact with each other, even if we're talking. And so I've written a lot of poems that have that in them.
That says a lot, doesn't it? The past and the present. Read us that stanza.
Sometimes the past and present stand on either side of a pane of glass and stare at each other.
I love that one. Was that easily written?
Well, I was thinking of a prison visit, but I ended up, I think because Rose told me, taking out the prison because the poem needed to be cleaner and not introduce that subject.
I agree. But it's good to put things in so you can take them out.
Yeah, I do kitchen sink them on the first time through.
Okay, we're at the Library of Congress and loving it. And we're going to hear some more. This is a strange shape.
I couldn't get my printer to right and left justify. And so this is a prose poem, but I had to print it this way for today.
But it is from margin to margin. That's what a prose poem is.
Yeah, I wanted a box.
I see.
Pralines. The mother comes in first, then a girl and a boy, each with the mother's exact face, each for some reason looking over their respective left shoulders, like nesting dolls, or triple parentheses, identical and serial. At home, they probably have trouble seeing the resemblance, but in this moment, they are as alike as eggs. Now the mother comes over to ask if she can take the extra chair from my cafe table. And behind her, the children's faces peep like matching heads on sticks, as if they are submitting the request in triplicate.
Why did that want to be from margin to margin or a box?
I wrote that poem sitting in the cafe pralines. And I just did it as a Facebook post because it was funny. And somebody said, oh, no, that's a prose poem. You should write it down on paper. And honestly, I just wrote it as I observed it. It hasn't been changed.
That That's a clue to everybody. You can do that. You're allowed to do that, people. Read us another poem and then a final poem.
Okay. You can hear me shuffling papers.
Well, lawyers do that, you know. You put so much time in your undergraduate and graduate work, you're allowed to shuffle.
Okay, sorry for the shuffling noise. Good housekeeping. My mother grew thorny, exotic plants that stabbed you and didn't make flowers. Our backyard a Roman legion of spears and pikes ready to butterfly your calves and shins and ankles. She liked colors with the personalities of collection agents, a rust orange shag wall to wall that punched your eyes like scabby knuckles, a sofa striped white and acid green as if they'd just let it out of jail. Like every other woman on our block, she saved those sticky stamps and traded them for Fiesta ware. But then threw the plates at my father so many times that the white triangles where the glaze chipped off made them leer like jack-o'-lanterns. Once, she bought a crimson lacquered table at a yard sale and sawed its legs off, short, until it stood like a veteran on stumps. I watched her go after it with a hacksaw, her face concentrated like a child with a book of matches, the dust flying off wood-colored, but also flecked with lurid red.
And now a final poem.
Things my mother taught me. To start a car, apply red lipstick first. When you drive by the country club in summer, roll down the windows and yell, "Napalm the bigots!" at the golfers. If mommy takes you to the Vietnam protests in your stroller, tell daddy we went shopping all day. At 5 o'clock, when the gin comes out, little girls need to stop talking. When gray-haired women dye their hair, the color that they get is menopause red. If somebody notices the scar where your mother burned you with her cigarette, call it a flower power tattoo. When you're 8 and the kids from the Catholic school charge across the street to chalk dirty Jew on your house, run. When you get to a safe distance, spit. When the teacher makes you play Mary in the Christmas pageant because she says you're so nice and dark, do it. When your father asks how was school today, lie. In 1945, when you're 13 and your parents pay for plastic surgery because they think you look too Jewish to make a decent marriage, bleed and bleed and bleed. Later, when it heals and people stop you on the street to ask if you're the movie star Jennifer Jones, tell them, hell yeah, that's who I am.
The power of Dorrit Carroll. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MAT Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family and the Sinipet Fund. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.